Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good evening and welcome to
Fun About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izett.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
Dang it.
Mary, you're going to get it one
week
day.
And I'm out of sync. Anyway, we're your co-host through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I hope that by episode 160, Mary will get that together, but she's been pretty good.
Dude, I was out last week. You can't.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better, and we're glad you're here. We did talk about how much we missed you last week, but I realize now that, well, Rachel's great, and you're fired. That's really
great.
It.
Thanks.
There's stuff going on. What's going on, Mary? Hold on, everybody's adjusting their
headphones.
Sorry,
I usually adjust my mic, my headphones before we start the show, and I didn't. All right, so let's start. We've got a couple of announcements. There's actually, you know, we're heading into warmer weather and lots of springtime activities, so there's a lot going on. First thing up is the Blue Point 12th Annual Cask Ales Festival out on Patchogue, Long Island. It's going to be April 16th, 2016. Tickets are still available. Chris and I will be there, along with my brother, who's going to be visiting from Atlanta.
We'll be repping Kelso. We'll be pouring a Carroll Garden Wit Dry Hop with Citra, and we'll be pouring a Pale Ale Dry Hop with Galaxy. People will come out in the box. There's a lot. I love cask ale, and it's a great way to kind of taste beer served in the traditional way. It's awesome.
And I haven't been for a couple, I think last time I went was a couple years ago, but they do some super interesting casks. So you get to taste, I mean, there's a lot of delicious beers and there's some really unusual stuff sometimes. So it's fun. And hopefully the weather will be beautiful. Regardless, they have tents. It's just a cool location and it's walkable from the Long Island Railroad. So it's super easy to get to. Next up is Tap New York. That's the beer festival of all New York state breweries.
Yep, that's on the April 23rd and 24th. There's still tickets available for that. And will you guys be there?
Yeah, we'll be repping Kelso once again. But I haven't told them exactly what we're bringing. But we're probably bringing a grape lambic style ale. Not a lambic ale, lambic style. An American sour with grape. And maybe our Flemish red. And probably our Kelso nut brown. Because I think that one just is a beautiful, crisp brown lager that just is righteous in a festival of weirdness.
That sounds great. I will not be there because it is Passover, where I cannot drink beer at all. And actually, if anybody's interested for what they can drink and what they can make on Passover, because it is a weird stigma that only terrible, terrible wines are kosher for Passover, and we need to fight that. I wrote a 5-part series. It's Alcohol Week in Juicy Magazine. That's JEWCY.com. I didn't make that. It's a Tablets offshoot cultural website, and tune in there to find out more about what you can brew for Passover and what you can drink on Passover.
Before we go on, let's go on to more announcements. Let's dive right into that since we're on the subject. Mm-hmm. So you wrote a 5-part series, and it's on juicy.com,
JEWCY. Yeah.
And the first article is out right now, and it talks about
What it means to be kosher for Passover and why yeast is not unkosher for Passover, rather.
What does kosher mean?
I don't want to get into what kosher means. That's a long story. But things that are not kosher for Passover include anything that is made with the 5 grains, which is wheat, barley, spelt rye, and oats. And anything that is leavened with those. Basically, anything that's come in contact with water that is made from one of those and has not cooked before 18 minutes are up. Long story about the 18 minutes. But because yeast itself is not what we call chametz, which is the word for the grains or whatever. It's not chametz. It's fine to have on Passover, which if you couldn't have yeast on Passover, you can have wine on Passover. And as a lot of people know, wine is part of the ritual of Passover. And so there's a lot of things that you can make. Basically anything that isn't beer or anything that isn't made from a grain, you can drink on Passover. I'll get into the details about, because there's very strict rules for Passover about what, you really can't touch anything that has been in contact with any of the five grains. Or if you're Ashkenaz like I am, you also can't have a lot of other things that I'm super mad about, because they are often milled with the grains. I'm mad about it, but then I've actually opened a box of lentils where there have been pieces of wheat in it, so I guess I understand that. But anyway, yeah, so there's I go into more detail in the article, but basically yeast is kosher for Passover. I trust labs to keep the strains separate from the strains that you would usually brew with.
Right.
So
they're pretty hardcore about that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're labs.
Well, you have to be, yeah.
Yep. Okay, going on to back to what's around.
We just have a couple more announcements. Yep. Savor is coming up in Washington, D.C. That's the Brewers Association Big American Craft Beer and Food Experience. It's an awesome weekend. It's June 3rd and 4th, and they have not sold out yet. I'm sure they will soon, so tickets are still available. That's Savor, S-A-V-O-R, craftbeer.com.
And more locally, this Sunday, Ferment here at, which we keep talking about. It's one of our favorite events annually. April 10th, Ferment at the Brooklyn Free School, 372 Clinton Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. It's a great time. It is free, but they do ask for donations towards the cause and to supporting things.
I will be there with a couple of my pets.
Yeah, and you should bring fermentation.
That's right.
So if you haven't fermented anything, but you would like to come and you would like to ferment something, there's a lot of stuff that you can quick ferment. I'm probably going to bring, we have some fermented vegetables that we have already completed and are ready, but I'm going to do a yogurt actually this week, and then the sourdough starter is going strong. I ignored it that I got from Tony Lamuaco, who we had on the show a few weeks ago, but anyway, I got it out and it is going strong, so I'm going to try to make some bread. But fast ferments, you could do a quick fermented kimchi that would only take a couple of days, and we'll get more into that actually
pickles.
With our guest who's nodding. I'm like, yes,
who's
let's
our
save
guest?
That discussion. So we're super excited to have Rob Handel on the show today.
Rob, welcome.
Thanks.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a chef at Heather Ridge Farm in the Bee's Knees Cafe. So we're a cafe that's located right on a livestock farm. We raise all of the meat, eggs, and honey that we use on the farm. And then we use all local vegetables, dairy, cheeses. And we do a lot of ferments in the cafe that we serve to our guests.
Awesome. And where is the cafe? Where is the cafe?
So we're in Preston Hollow. It's the Northern Catskills. Right where the Catskills, the Hudson Valley, and the Capital District meet.
Okay.
So about 3 hours from New York.
You said you do a lot of dairy?
We use a lot of local dairy. We do a couple of dairy ferments. We do some yogurts and kefirs and things like that.
From milk from
yeah,
animals
we get,
on your farm?
No, not from our farm.
Okay.
The dairy is such a unique farming thing where you either do dairy or you do anything else. So we get all of our milk through Cowbella, which is they're a dairy located in Jefferson, New York, and they're a small dairy. They sell non-homogenized cream line milk, so it's pasteurized but it's non-homogenized, so it's great for making fresh cheeses. We do like a fromage blanc, we do ricotta with that.
That's exciting stuff. How long have you personally been fermenting?
I've been fermenting for years. I started brewing kombucha probably about 8 years ago, and picked it up from there.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
I did make some fruit wines and stuff in high school, but other than that, I got brewing seriously after that.
So you do a lot of different ferments. I'm trying to think. You also do foraging up there, right?
Yeah. So we're our farm has about 150 acres on it, and then we lease a farm that's right next to us that has even more land. So there's hundreds of acres in the mountains of things to forage. So a lot of what I do, I go out into the woods, I forage, and then I use fermentation to either make some of the bitter greens that I forage more palatable or to actually preserve things to use year-round. One of the struggles of having a farm-to-table cafe in the Catskill Mountains is that the season is so short. You know, it's really a 6-month season. So I've developed a lot of techniques to be able to preserve stuff in the summer, in the spring, and the fall, and then use it up all winter long so that we still have local products throughout the winter.
Awesome.
And you preserve, you also do charcuterie, right?
We do some charcuterie. Right now we serve cooked charcuterie because we aren't set up to do dry curing. At home I do a lot of fermented salami and dry curing and whole mussel stuff, but I'm just not set up to do that there yet, but that's something we're working on.
Cool.
How long have you been a chef at the Bee's Knees?
This is going to be my third season.
Been open?
The Bee's Knees, the farm itself has been open for about 12 years, I believe. The Bee's Knees has been open for 7, and this is going to be my third season there. So
let's dive right in. Let's ask, what are some of your favorite ferments right now that you're doing, or some of the highlights, maybe either seasonal or just that you particularly love?
Yeah, so one of my favorite things, which I loved it so much because it was so unexpected, and it's actually coming up to the season to do it, is a nettle beer. And it's not technically a beer because there's no grain involved. It's really just the nettles, the water, and some sort of fermentable sugar. You know, I usually use white sugar because it gives a cleaner flavor profile. But the nettles, and I was really skeptical when I had heard about this, that the nettles would create this beer-like flavor. But it's really remarkable how you do have these hop notes and these kind of yeast notes, and you make a tea out of the nettles. Something else I've been doing is adding spruce tips to that. And the spruce tips give it this really nice citrusy tartness. And we aren't set up to brew beer and sell the beer, but I brew the beer and then use it as an ingredient in the food.
Mm-hmm. And you can drink it at home. I mean, you're making stuff for home consumption as well,
I assume. Yeah, you know, a lot of these things start as something that I make at home, and if it's really good, I brew a larger batch for the cafe.
Awesome. Right.
Yeah. Well, what do you make with the nettle beer?
So the nettle beer, I've made beer cheese sauces that we serve with pretzels. Uh-huh. You know, we do these 5-course tasting dinners. So for something special like that, I'll make a batch of beer cheese sauce using one of the local cheeses that we have, the nettle beer, and then we serve warm pretzels with it. I've also used it in some emulsified sausages, and those are sausages like mortadella, bologna, you know, hot dogs. They have that really smooth consistency. Mm-hmm. And that's actually achieved by mixing liquid in with the meat and the fat and forming an emulsion. So usually you use ice chips, which keeps the meat cold and then adds the liquid. But what I've done is I've frozen the nettle beer and added that in, and that adds, you know, I've made, in Germany they have a sausage called Weißwurst, which is a veal sausage, and we don't raise veal on the farm, so I make it with pork, and I use that beer in it, and it's really phenomenal. You know, we do a forage mustard with garlic mustard seeds, and that and the Weißwurst is really great together.
That sounds amazing.
Sounds cranking.
Now, the nettle beer, are you adding hops to that, or is it kind of technically a gruit?
No, it's really more of a gruit.
Okay.
So I usually, when I describe it to people, I say it's a nettle beer because that's it's a flavor profile that people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more like a gruit, and I suppose it's not even really technically a gruit because there's no grain in it. You know, it's really a nettle wine, but the flavor profile is... And, you know, I've noticed a couple other people who I know and who I follow who forage, they've been making a lot of these herbal beers. And, you know, everybody acknowledges that it's not really a beer. It's not made with grain. But the flavor profile is so similar to beer that, you know, that's the only thing we can figure out.
Well, and the alcohol, you're doing what, around beer strength alcohol,
yeah,
not wine, so like 5-6% or
exactly,
something like that.
Exactly, and I've been using, I haven't been using wild yeast for that, so I've been pitching it with beer yeasts.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Cool. So, and you're foraging. Are these stinging nettle? Is that the same kind of nettle that you're using?
Nettles.
So funny, I was just talking about this with a friend this weekend who we were actually talking about nettle gruit. So for those of us who can't forage, I'm guessing we could get this at the green market for a very small amount of time, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there's somebody selling nettles at the green market. One thing I want to try this year is I want to dry some of the nettles and see how it works with dehydrated nettles.
Ah.
You know, the nettles, when you pick them up fresh, they'll sting you. You know, they're called stinging nettles. And that's actually not so much a function of them having thorns, but there's a chemical in there that causes the irritation. And that's neutralized either by heating it or by dehydrating it.
Ah.
So I'm thinking I'm going to dehydrate a bunch of nettle. You know, I have tons and tons of nettles growing, you know, both at the farm and where I live. So,
can you freeze them? Could you freeze them fresh?
You might be able to. Sometimes with forage things, the freezing changes the flavor, though.
Yeah.
But I'm going to do more experimentation this year to see how I can preserve the nettles rather than making, gallons and gallons and gallons of this beer.
Right. And then do you ever combine like add yarrow or something else that's...
One thing that I've added so far is spruce tips.
Oh, yeah. That's. And are you picking those fresh as well?
Yes. Yeah.
Awesome.
So they have this really interesting citrusy tart flavor. So that makes a really great summer beer. You know, reminds me of, more of a vice beer than anything else.
Do your spruce tips fresh or wet?
Yeah, and the great thing is they're usually out at the same time to some extent. You know, it's when the spruce tips come out, it's usually in June, and
that's just like the new growth on the spruce.
Yeah,
right?
So if you have spruce, you could also use firs. If you have those trees, you'll notice in the spring they grow to be maybe about an inch and a half long, and it's this really vibrant green. It's a lot brighter than the green on the rest of them. And they're really tender. You can actually, what I've done is I've chopped them up and added them to honey, and ooh. I serve that with cheese. And you can use spruce, you can use some firs, some pines, and hemlock. Not the water hemlock, which is poisonous, but hemlock trees.
Ooh, I think a spruce tip short mead would be delicious.
Oh, I bet it would. I do want to experiment this year. The problem with doing all of these things is that the season is so short, and you don't want to commit to doing a whole ton of this stuff and have it not work out.
Right.
So every year I do small batches trying to experiment, but it's a whole year before you can
do it again.
You can make it again. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So this year I want to, I tapped a bunch of maple trees at my house and I made, 11 quarts of maple syrup. I want to try doing some with maple, some with honey, and work on some other sweeteners and see what that gets.
Awesome. Man. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with more.
Ferment about it.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you. Have you listened to A Taste of the Past? It's a show devoted to connecting our current food world with its storied past. Host and culinary historian Linda Palacio welcomes chefs, scientists, authors, scholars, and revolutionaries into the studio to discuss food culture and history from around the globe.
Have you seen the culture of food change over the past 25, 30 years?
Incredible. It's been incredible.
Linda covers content ranging from the history of black chefs in the White House to behavioral psychology and the evolution of Italian food in America. You can listen to A Taste of the Past anytime on heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes and Stitcher.
Welcome back to episode 158 of Ferment About It on heritageradionetwork.org. We are here in the studio with Rob Handel from Bee's Knees Cafe at Heather Ridge Farm. That's heather-ridge-farm.com. And it is in Preston Hollow, New York. And we're talking about fermentations of all kinds that he incorporates into the seasonal menu fare at the cafe. You use fermentation a lot to make things more palatable, things that you forage, and you suggested that you use acorns too as one of those things. How do you make an acorn palatable?
Well, that's a great question. Really, the biggest challenge, most of the acorns that we have are red oaks, and the red oaks have a lot more tannins than the other acorns. So you have to boil them with multiple changes of water to leach out all those tannins. The way the Native Americans would do it is they would put it in a river or a creek and let the water. I've heard of people actually...
Like after they break them open?
Yeah.
So they collect all the middle part. What do you call that? The meat.
Yeah, the actual nut. Yeah, they shell them and there's the actual nut meat. Yeah. The way some people do it these days, and I've never done it because it sounds a little ridiculous, is they actually put it in the tank of their toilet. Because it's separate from the bowl.
I guess that makes sense.
Every time you flush the toilet, there's fresh water.
Yeah,
so people who don't have access to a creek do that. I've never done that.
Makes sense. I mean,
that's an interesting modern day
take. Yeah, they bleach out there, but I still don't buy it. So what I do is we crack them, and then we just boil them with multiple changes of water. And then you can actually grind them and make a dough. So the thing is, because they're already wet, some people will dry them out and then grind them dry. I actually puree them wet and then use them to make dosas.
So you're making just a traditional fermented dosage.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dough.
Yeah, with the with the acorns in it.
With acorns.
Awesome. How does it taste? What's it? How does it taste like? Yeah.
It's hard to explain. It's a little bit nutty. The acorn is it's a pretty neutral flavor, though. You know, the fermentation, that tanginess of the dosa is really what comes through more than anything else.
Right. So you're getting similar flavor characteristics in that way. Just kind of the background is a little bit different.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool. What else are some of your favorite ferments that you've been doing?
Well, speaking of kimchi, we do I do a wild greens kimchi. And the greens in it change all the time. You know, it depends on what's out and what's in, you know, great abundance. But I try to mix some of the more pungent greens with some milder greens. And things like curly dock, which, you know, it's this big, it's a lot of times it grows in people's gardens and it's a pest. But the leaves are a little bit tough. So the kimchi is great for that because the fermentation really, it softens it up. Some of the more pungent herbs, the salt balances out the bitterness, and then the fermentation changes the flavor profile.
And then are you just doing it like you would a regular kimchi and like, you know, with a brine and similar kimchi flavoring, or do you have your own take?
No,
Or spicing?
Yeah, no, I use pretty standard kimchi, you know, the chili powder and garlic, scallions, that kind of thing.
Awesome. And then I know one thing that you like to do is you said you like to use a lot of your fermented foods in dishes.
Yeah.
So to complement, and I know, so I had made a batch of just straight up pickles from cucumbers, and I let them go a little too long and they're really soggy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to make something else with them. I was actually just going to make like a simple dip or, you know, like a sauce to put on something else. So I think that's one thing is that a lot of people, when they ferment their veggies, they have so much they don't want to just eat them all straight, but they don't really know what to do with them. So what are some examples? I know you had talked about, you know, using your gruet or the nettle beer.
Yeah. Yeah, well, with the kimchi, I make spring rolls with them.
Ooh,
you know, I'll do these duck spring rolls where I braise the duck with, you know, five spice and then a little bit of plum sauce, the kimchi, and the duck in a rice paper with a little dipping sauce. And it's really nice. It adds a lot of complexity to that. If I had soggy pickles, something like that, which does happen, you know, these kind of things get tucked in the fridge. And I think something like that would be a great addition to some fresh cucumber soup. You know, you have this kind of very fresh green cucumber flavor, acts like, you know, punctuated with this tangy, salty, and the texture isn't as much of a problem if you're, you know, if you're eating a soup like that. I've fermented grape leaves, wild grape leaves, as a preservation technique to preserve them to make domadas and things like that. The garlic mustard, you know, we make vinegars and then use that to make mustards. So,
you also speak about not having the patience to wait for fruit to ripen, and you use unripe fruit. What are some unripe fruits that you do?
Well,
and flower buds, too, right?
Yeah. So strawberries are one, and that always kind of surprises people. With those, I often do a vinegar pickle on the strawberries because the strawberry flavor actually comes out, but...
Ooh, that's it. So you're taking green, like, not quite ripe strawberries.
Yeah, yeah, and it's funny. You know, the first time I did it, I go to this farm that we buy a lot of our stuff from, and they're known for their strawberries. You know, they grow these great strawberries. And I roll up at, like, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, and I said, "Do you have any green strawberries?" And the guy says, "Do you want green strawberries?" So they went out, and they picked some green strawberries for me. And it's great because they have a lot more texture than the ripe strawberries. They aren't soft. They're more like a cucumber pickle. But you get at the end, you get this kind of fresh strawberry flavor without the sweetness.
That's fun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, with the flower buds, I make a lot of wild capers using flower buds.
Ooh.
Yeah, so milkweed blossoms, before the flowers actually open, when they're still a little bud, I'll snip them off of the stem. They grow in kind of a flat umbral, and I'll snip them off of that and then brine them, ferment them briefly, and then store them. And they're great. They have they don't have quite as much bite as a caper does. You know, the texture's a little softer, but they have that same kind of briny, salty quality. You know, unripe elderberries, unripe wild currants. There's some other flowers. I can't think of some of the other flowers that I use now. But yeah.
This is very, you're very inspiring with this. Like, our brains are going crazy about wanting to get back into that kitchen now.
Definitely.
It.
So since we were talking about quick ferments before, if somebody, what would you recommend for people that wanted to do some quick ferments?
That's a good question. Well, you know, you can do quick cucumber pickles or, you know, just take a couple days, and they really, you know, you can leave them overnight and they'll be salty, and they won't quite be half sours maybe, but you can leave them anywhere from a day to a week or two, and that's a nice ferment. Mm-hmm. The quick kimchis, those are great also.
Yeah, because those are like a couple days too, or if you wanted to do a quick.
Exactly, yeah. The yogurts are great. You had mentioned doing a yogurt. I'm trying to think of some other things.
And yogurt is very easy. Let's talk about that, since we're going to talk about that. Because I have I use a sous vide stick to make my yogurt.
Oh, that's perfect.
Basically, the whole principle of making yogurt is that you just want, if you're using a mesophilic culture, which is typically what most commercial yogurts are.
Yeah, most Bulgarian style yogurts, though.
Yeah, mesophilic. Mesophilic.
Yeah.
So thermophilic is what I'm saying. Mesophilic is room temperature. Mm-hmm. Thermophilic I'm speaking backwards. Thermophilic is what, so they work at about 109, 110 degrees, mm-hmm. the lactobacillus cultures. So if you were to get a fresh yogurt from your local store, then you could just take a little bit of that and add it to some milk that you've pasteurized at home, cool down to 109, and then I keep it with my sous vide stick at 109 for about 5 hours. And it's super easy. I know I haven't played with the mesophilic yet, which is room temperature.
That's room temperature, yeah.
That's also
I haven't done much with that either. Yeah. I usually use the thermophilic. And that's great because anybody can make it. You know, every grocery store has. I usually use Stonyfield or Stony Brook. I can never remember which one it is. Mm-hmm. But I just add some of that as the starter. But, you know, as long as you look at the container and it lists live active cultures, it'll work. The other thing that's really great, and a lot of people don't think to make it, is creme fraiche, which is just, I use cream and I use buttermilk as a starter. And that's actually mesophilic.
So you just do that at room temp.
Exactly.
Are you culturing the cream first? I mean, are you pasteurizing the cream first?
No. Okay. Where I am, I have a hard time getting non-ultra pasteurized cream.
Okay.
You know, most cream in the store is high temp pasteurized. And typically that's not great for fermentation, but I've had no problem making creme fraiche. You know, sometimes it takes a couple of days, but I usually add maybe a quarter of a cup of buttermilk to a pint of cream and just leave it in a jar in a warmish spot. You know, on top of the fridge is usually a little bit warmer than the rest of the kitchen. And within a couple of days, you know, you just taste it every day. You have this nice, thick, nutty creme fraiche.
Yeah, that's really good. And the other thing is that I like the texture of regular yogurt. Mm-hmm. I don't actually love Greek yogurt. Chris is a big Greek
yogurt.
Yeah. But I do like to strain my yogurt to the point where it's like a cream cheese texture.
Exactly, yeah.
And I spread that on bread or use that. So I like that. The other thing, though, that I've read about is actually doing flavored yogurt. So there's a lot of flavored yogurts kind of trending right now, especially in New York City. There's a lot of savory yogurts that are on the market. But I'm on this big tea kick right now. So Rachel and I went to a coffee and tea festival a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I was reading, because you can infuse milk with any flavors before you culture it. So doing tea-flavored yogurt.
Oh, that's
so
a great
do like
idea.
An Earl Grey. Mm-hmm. And you could infuse it afterward as well. You could either infuse the milk before and then culture it, or infuse it afterward as well.
Yeah, and
I think
depending on what you were infusing it with, the 110, 109 degrees may be warm enough to encourage that infusion. You know, if you're using something like lavender blossoms, which are, you know, they have a really strong flavor and it's pretty volatile to begin with. I think that would probably work.
Yeah, because you could just add it while you're culturing
the
yogurt. Yeah.
Exactly.
And the temp would be low enough that you wouldn't blow off the aromas.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think it's also high enough to get those aromas to release.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Something like cinnamon or star anise that's a little tougher, that may not be warm enough. You may be better off bringing the milk up to a warmer temperature.
So like if you pasteurize the milk before.
Exactly.
What else? Yeah, what other kinds of yogurt creations have you?
Well, I do the strained yogurt thing quite often. And then I'll add, you know, one thing that's really nice to do. I don't do it at the cafe all too much, but I do it a lot at home when I'm having a party, is I strain the yogurt and then I just drizzle it with olive oil and za'atar and olives and crudité. And it's a really nice alternative to some of those saltier, more fatty dips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good. And I've been using my yogurt. I'm addicted to pancakes right now, too, for some reason. So
that's crazy.
Yogurt is great.
I've been using my yogurt in the pancakes as well.
Yeah, I've done that. Sometimes, you know, I'm home and I open the fridge and whether I have milk, buttermilk, yogurt, you know, I just sour cream. Those are all great in pancakes.
Yeah, whatever. Yes, exactly.
It's great to marinate chicken in also as or anything, really. But you don't want to leave it in too long because you don't want the acid to start to break down the meat too much where it gets a strange texture.
So what's a good marination time for yogurt and chicken?
So
and
it depends
fowl.
On the meat, yeah. So for poultry, like chicken, turkey, that kind of thing, you know, maybe 2-3 hours. For something like pork or beef, you could leave it in overnight a little bit longer. But I like to use yogurt and cilantro and some cumin and
good.
A little bit of lemon and
Then you make sodas for the cafe.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because they're not fermented technically, but they're really easy to make, and I think they're a nice complement to
Be fermented. Yeah. So I don't ferment them just for ease of use at the cafe, but what I do is I make a syrup and then I add it to seltzer to create the soda. We actually just got a jockey box and a setup to start doing draft sodas. So that's what I'm going to be force carbonating them. But one thing that I do is a 20-ingredient root beer.
Ooh.
So I started this a couple winters ago when we had one of these horrible winters where everybody was kind of shut inside all winter long. And I went, I looked on the internet for all these root beer recipes, and I was getting all these old recipes from the 1800s that had, you know, these huge long lists of ingredients. So I was just going through them, and I tried each recipe, and then I took some things from one recipe and other recipes, and I synthesized this root beer recipe. So it uses all whole barks, roots, herbs, spices. You know, there's no flavorings or anything in it. And I make a concentrated syrup, and then we add that to seltzer to make the soda at the cafe.
Now, are you using things that you forage for that?
I'm not able to forage it in that great a quantity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, dandelion root, yellow dock root, that's a lot of work digging them, washing them, drying them. So right now I'm sourcing, everything is sourced through Frontier, which is
a great urban spice company.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we get big orders in from Frontier for root beer syrup.
Awesome. Yeah. And you're just making a basic simple syrup with it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. I add all of the botanicals to the pot with the water, make a decoction, you know, boil it for a while, strain it off, add the sugar, and that's it.
Yeah, I love I've made a bunch of homemade sodas in the past as well.
Yeah.
It's
and that
super
if you
fun.
Wanted to ferment that, you could either not add as much sugar, you know, factor in the dilution when you're making the syrup, or dilute it afterwards and then pitch it with some yeast, close it off, and let it ferment.
Yeah.
I actually, for Christmas one year, I did that. I made fermented sodas, and I gave it to some family members with very clear instructions about keeping it in the fridge.
Yes.
Right. Well, nobody listened. All my family put it on the countertops and came home to soda and broken glass all over the place. Yeah. So that was the last year I did that.
That's the advantage of kegging these sodas.
Exactly.
Is that then you can, you know, keep them in there.
Exactly. And the root beer syrup, one of the great things about that is it's a great cooking ingredient also. I braise short ribs with it.
Makes sense.
It's just fantastic, you know, with the fatty, rich short ribs, the sugar, it's really good.
So what else are you, we're going to have to wrap up, but since we're coming into warmer weather and, you know, there's going to be a lot of other things growing, what else are you looking forward to doing, you know, kind of early spring, fermenting early spring?
Early spring, well, the elder blossoms come out in early spring. So those are the flowers for the elderberries. It's what Saint Germain is made out of.
Mm-hmm.
It's this really great floral aroma. Those and the black locust blossoms, which are, you know, black locusts are these big trees. They have these white blossoms, and they're remarkably like jasmine.
Ooh.
And they're only out for about a week. So I make sodas with those, but this year I'm looking forward to fermenting that a little bit. You know, I want to try coming up with a wine or a champagne sparkling style wine with that, and then see where that goes.
That sounds fun.
Now, how
that
are you just fine. Picking those?
Yeah, yeah.
And then boiling them.
Yeah,
like
they're a little
simple syrup,
they're a little
kind of,
delicate.
Or,
so what I do is I usually bring the water up to a simmer. You know, I'll bring it up to a boil. I'll turn it off. I'll let it cool just a little. Then I add the blossoms, cover it, and just let it sit.
Okay.
You know, off the heat like that.
And infuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I did last year was I made a syrup with those, just a simple syrup, and then I canned it. So I've been using that all winter long, and it's really fabulous. You know, I've been making sodas with it, and then I've made ice creams and cakes and all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Because I've had a lot of elderberry flower, you know, besides Saint Germain, but other things. But I've never heard of the black locust flower.
Yeah,
locust tree.
And I don't know how common they are down here, but up in the Catskills, we have them everywhere. And the trick is just finding ones that are low enough. They tend to grow very tall.
Yeah.
And you can't get the blossoms. But if you can find ones that are low enough, that's another thing that somebody in the green market may be willing to bring down.
Yeah,
I know in France.
I have to befriend some.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, I need to, yeah. So I can get somebody to bring me some of these blossoms.
The farmer and the brewer should be friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. They do carry them at markets in France, I know. They call them false acacia, and you can go to farmers markets and get these big bundles of locust branches.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool. You got anything else, Kuzmi?
No, I'm going to come visit you, like, pronto. I want to go to the cafe.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to get up there. So when are you guys open?
So our farm store, we have a farm store with all of our meats, locally produced wool products, pottery, cheeses, the whole works. That's open Wednesday through Sunday from 11 to 3. And then the cafe itself is open Saturday and Sunday from 11 to 3. We do the tasting dinners monthly. If you go to the website, heather-ridge-farm.com, there's a whole calendar of different events. So we do some more casual dinners. We do the five-course tasting dinners, which are a little bit more elaborate.
Awesome. Yeah, we definitely will have to make it up there. We'll take a little weekend trip. Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about what you have in mind for the next tasting dinner? I know the last one was, last week?
A couple weeks ago. I have the menu. I've made the menu up, but I can't remember what I put on it. So I don't know.
Wait, I got to ask about your llamas. You have guard llamas, right?
We do have guard llamas.
I love llamas.
The llamas guard the sheep.
Yeah. So actually, not too far from us, there's a llama rescue.
And, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the guy used to be a llama breeder back when breeding llamas was a thing. And what happened was there was a big bubble in that market. Everybody was breeding these llamas, and the market all collapsed, and then there was all these llamas that nobody wanted to take care of anymore because they weren't worth anything. So this guy had been a breeder, realized the problem that was going on, and he became a llama rescue. So he takes in hundreds of llamas every year and finds homes for them. Wow. So we work with him, and we get the rescue llamas from him, and they're great guard animals. They really bond with the sheep and the goats, who are the two animals that really require guarding. And they work.
Are you
pairs.
Guarding against, like, coyotes or
coyotes, dogs? You know, yeah. If a dog gets out,
yeah.
Mostly coyotes and dogs are the two big things. And they work in pairs, so we keep them in pairs. And if a person comes up to the fence, you know, they don't attack people, but they're very curious and they want to see you and know what you are. And
they're like the bouncer asking for ID.
Exactly. And one of them will run over to the fence and get right in your face to smell you and see what's going on. And the other one will round up the sheep and the goats and kind of bring them off to the other side of the field.
That's wow. Amazing.
So they're really amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we use their fiber to make socks. You know, they have to be sheared every year to so that they don't overheat in the summer.
So do you have them processed somewhere, or do you process them?
We have them processed somewhere, yeah. Yeah, but we ship them out to a small mill that keeps all of our stuff together.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of places you send it off and it gets pooled.
Oh, yeah.
The more common thing is that they pool your wool or your fiber, you know, whatever, with everybody else's, and you just get back socks that may have yours or may not.
Oh, so they do the socks for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
All of our fiber gets kept in the same batch, and we get the socks back. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mary's on a pancake obsession right now, but she used to have a sock obsession, was trying to make
well,
the
I knit and
sock.
Crochet and felt and stuff, so.
Oh, socks are difficult to knit, though.
Yeah. I had to give them up at some point.
I can usually finish one sock by the time
Then you have to make another one.
I know, but then I put it away and say, oh, I'll start the other one next week, and then you just have a collection of
socks.
Are
cool.
I like single socks.
I like single socks. Things that come in, like, one.
Yeah.
Before, you know, there's a market for llama therapy out there. If you ever decide to get into the market,
we have a friend who has a llama farm, and she does a lot of llama therapy.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah,
it's pretty fun. So you bring the llamas, and they just
well, we
feel
definitely
good.
Have to come up and visit.
Yeah,
so.
I need some llama therapy.
Yeah, we actually one of our llamas, one of our regular customers, who's a close friend. They're getting married this spring. And they asked that one of our llamas be their ring bearer.
Yes.
So we're going to fashion a device to hold the ring, a little pillow, and the llama is going to be their ring bearer.
So good.
Oh, God.
That's great.
That sounds amazing.
Heather Ridge Farm, heather-ridge-farm.com, the Bee's Knees Cafe. Rob Handel, you are awesome and inspiring, I can't wait to come taste your food.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on.
No, thanks for having me.
Okay. Fun man about it.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Clutch to your burden.
everybody. I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.